An audience of business owners asked me questions for 4 hours. Here are the best moments.
I own a company that basically scoops up dog shit.
Sweet. And, I love these types of business. No one cancels.
Yeah. We're doing about $2 million a year, and I want to get to $10 million a year as fast as possible.
Poo-poo and profit. Sorry, go ahead.
And our business, it's somewhat seasonal as far as the acquisition goes. We basically double every first quarter of the year when all the snow is melting off and everything. But through the rest of the year, I want to start looking at acquiring other dog companies, basically. So my question is, when you're going to acquire other companies, how do you integrate it with your company to basically not light your money on fire and to maximize the enterprise value for an investor?
So obviously the price that you're buying that is going to be a huge factor in how you structure the deal. Are you keeping the operators on afterwards or no?
It probably depend on the business and the deal.
Yeah. I mean,
I would have some sort of big incentive for them to have like a 1 year bonus, basically post integration. And so that way they're going to be highly incentivized to, you know, you could put half at the end of the first year, like, hey, like we're in this together. If this doesn't work, then you're not going to get paid. And I think I think it's pretty fair for especially a small business. Because I'm assuming the revenue that you're buying is probably like 150 somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. What were we saying? Poo-poo platter, profit, yes. So making the deal structure. I would try and separate the business out into what the components are, right? So it's like you have the routes that they do for, you know, poop pickups or whatever, right? So you've got the customer list, then you've got the people who do the poop scooping, and then you probably have some sort of administrative stuff. I don't know if they have sales or marketing. I'm guessing you're pretty good at sales and marketing, so you don't need their sales and marketing. You're trying to buy the book of business. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you'll probably just end up having an SOP for each of the core components. And there's a really good book for you. No one else needs to read this. It's called How to Make a Few Billion Dollars. The guy just did 3 roll-ups over his whole career, and each roll-up he sold for like $10 billion. And so it's really just understanding that all the business have components, and you basically just have a massive checklist that you do when you integrate a business. Like, that's literally it. It's just the world's longest checklist, and every single integration you do, you get a little bit better, and you add things to the checklist until eventually, like, you've covered every single thing, and you can go faster and faster. And have you studied waste management?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because literally, I mean,
yeah.
You should. I mean, that's literally how they grow. So finding routes, I mean, I would study everything about that business, but it's really just breaking down the components and having SOPs that are associated with them.
Do you need to rebrand the businesses you buy under the same brand to make it more attractive to investors? Does that not really matter as much?
I would probably rebrand it. If you really want to do the big play, you'll get a premium for it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Hi.
Hello.
So my question is regarding email marketing.
Cool.
And the thing is that we currently have a quite good lead magnet,
okay,
which is free and which is good. But the problem is that as soon as they opt in and start to get emails from us, it's only like an open rate from 20 to 25% something. How can I push that up?
So two things. One is how good the lead magnet is. So I know you say people want it, but the question is how good is it once they get it? I mean, fundamentally, the value deliver always reinforces them consuming more value. And so like you grow an audience by delivering more to them than it costs them to consume it. And so they make a good trade on their time compared to other trades on their time from other people they could be consuming information from. I mean, fundamentally, that's how I built my brand, right? And so if you think about the lead magnet as a microcosm of that, then that's that. The other obvious one is just that you need to split test subject heads. Are you split testing subject heads on a regular basis for the email flow?
I'm not exactly sure because I'm not in charge for the email marketing yet.
I'll bet you're not. So yeah, I mean, so like a lot of this stuff just for everyone is like, I get asked sometimes a lot of questions that can be solved with a test and not like I can tell you the answer. And so when we want to figure out pricing, we test pricing. You guys saw a fuck up yesterday from it, right? So like we test pricing, and that's how we do things. Like we just try it out and we see. And so we do the same thing. We just like see if this headline works better, and then we see. Like we run tests constantly, and I would say that's probably one of the things that has worked really well for us. And What I would warn you against is, like, because you're on the, like, if there's a pendulum of testing, right? There's like, we test everything all the time, and there's like, we haven't tested things, what's a test? Like, there's kind of a sweet spot, because whenever you do test, there's a cost of testing, which is guaranteed. You have a cost of change, like, you have mess ups that happen, right? And so those are guaranteed, but the upside of the test isn't guaranteed. And so you want to make sure that the tests that you're doing are worth it. And so
for you,
the cost of the test, doing a split, you know, a split test on a subject ad, is probably not that much. If you want to test a change in your offer, it costs more. You got to retrain the team. You got to retrain the fulfillment. There's more things that have to happen. So there's kind of like low cost tests and high cost tests, and not all high cost tests are going to have high output. And sometimes low cost tests have massive output. And so you want to kind of order these from like, okay, what is the lowest likelihood test that could have the most output? And you just literally order them. And you're like, all right, well, let's grab one off of here. And we do them in that order.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we literally have a big list that's like Alex's ideas.
Where do I find that list?
No, for my stuff, right? And so we, so this is to your ADD question that you had earlier. Like, I highly recommend doing this. It took me a long time to learn, for Layla and I to figure out this dynamic, was that I had about one new idea for our business per day. And Layla's like, we can do like one a quarter. And so I was like, well, what do I do with all these extras? And so I would just bottle them up and just go nuts, right? And so instead, I did two things. One is that I started making content to get ideas out, get my creative juices out. So it's kind of an outlet. So you guys are like the product of a creative outlet for me. And the other thing is having my big list of ideas. And it's literally called Alex's Big List of Ideas. And I just have this massive, because you're like, lose it. So you write it down. And then
next week, you're like, you know what?
It actually wasn't that good of an idea, but I was about to change the whole company. And now I actually think it's fine, right? And so by having that list, it kind of gives you a little bit of space between them, because you're always emotionally invested in it when it's your idea and it's fresh. And so giving it some time to settle, it allows me to look at these and be like, no, even with like a month of sleep, this is a good idea. We should test this one, and it's worth the cost. And so that's how I get some of that creative juice out, and I make sure that the tests we have are the highest return.
So in regards to email marketing, you just think of a nice fancy title, and then you just write it down and sleep some days about it.
So honestly, like, the first thing I would do is just Google like split test headlines for subjects.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you could probably find like 500 and be like, okay, which of these apply to my niche?
All right, perfect. Thank you.
You bet. Box. Yes, sir.
Hey, man.
Yes, hello.
I have a SaaS company. It's an e-commerce fulfillment platform that specializes in dropshipping fulfillment.
Cool.
We have super, super high churn, 33%. Because
a month?
A month, okay. Yeah. Because 99% of our traffic is a new business that they're trying to start an e-commerce business. We've done surveying, market research.
I'm going to make your day, but keep going.
Okay. Their issue is they need to find which products they want to sell and drive profitable traffic. Sure. We just can't figure out how to operationalize that.
Yeah. So you have something called structural churn, which is something to not lose sleep over.
Okay. Thank you.
Like, Shopify has more churn than you do.
Yeah.
So it's the nature of getting into the VSMB space. So VSMB is very small business center, SMB, and mid-market, and then you go up to enterprise. But you're in the VSMB space, which is almost the same as consumer.
That's just the game.
Yeah. But the good news is there's a gazillion of them. And so that's the trade.
It's an infinite market almost. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like, if you think about what Shopify's business model is, it's like, I mean, it's in your space, right? Is that they have a very small fee for people to start, and then they get their upside from payments for the people who self-select as the, you know, highest and best users. And so they make money on people who make no money. And then once those people make a lot of money, they make more money with them. And so it's kind of like a dual-sided monetization structure. And so that might be something that I would explore.
Yeah, we're looking into payments. But yeah. I'm trying to feel like, I thought that was the constraint in my business, but...
Churn?
Yeah.
I mean, 3% a month for VSMBs is not bad.
33%.
Oh, 33.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's worse than 3.
Yeah. super high.
That's 11 times worse than 3. I was like, dude, you're doing fine.
I love 3.
I was like, I'm going to make your day.
Dude, I love 3.
You're doing great. Yeah, got it. Yeah, so I'll bet you can get that probably closer down to 10.
Yeah.
I would look at what Shopify, I think they're like at 10, but like it's high.
Yeah.
And so everything, so my recommendation, because obviously we have school and so I'm in the VSMB world, is you want to think about improving the product through elimination rather than addition. So it's, how can I eliminate things from the product that people aren't using? What are the things, like, the number one reason people cancel is overwhelm.
They get distracted.
overwhelmed. It's too many things. They don't know what to do. And so it's really trying to pull as, this goes for service too, by the way, trying to pull as many things out. And like you can introduce things later that they don't necessarily need yet. So it's really just thinking, what is the one thing I need them to do right now? And then until they do that, I'm not going to show them something else. And then once they have done that, I will show them the next thing to do. It's just trying to keep as little friction as humanly possible. And that's like the 100 golden BBs. It's no, there's no silver bullet. It's just looking at right now, like you probably have a data guy, hopefully on the team that can run like a regression analysis on the cohorts.
Yeah.
And so if you, do you know what your activation points are?
Yeah, we know the golden path.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well then just, I mean, literally all resources go towards that thing. Like, yeah. If that is the constraint of the business, then I don't care about getting new members. I care about them insofar as we need to test the cohort out to make sure that it's working. But I'm not doing any growth initiatives. I'm not doing any new features. Everything that we're focused on is how do we get more people to that activation point? And I don't care about anything else. That's it. And so if the activation point is right, then churn will go down. If the activation point that you have is wrong, then you have to find what it really is.
Yeah.
G'day, Alex. How you doing?
Hello.
Hello. My name's Josh. I own a business in Australia, and we help universities.
Australia.
And we help universities or unis in Australia keep their students and keep them happy so they don't drop out. So your college video was really applicable to us. I think the Australian government was listening to you because they introduced a policy this year. I know. I came to tell you that news in person.
Policy?
I know. they introduced a policy where Australian unis to receive funding have to dramatically increase the amount of low socioeconomic students, the one that benefits most from uni, which is cool. And then they released a policy that said essentially $60 million of student funding has to go to clubs, societies, fraternities to support those students. So 8 years ago, I started a business on the premise that uni should really invest in supporting students because it keeps their customers there and that's good for unis and good for students. So I have a woman in a $60 million red dress.
Okay.
And my question is, normally I'm selling to a student engagement professional. It's their first professional job. Now I'm selling to their boss's boss.
Okay.
So I have a value equation basically for student retention that we've created this instrument, which shows them why students drop out, where their dropout rates are, benchmarks it, exactly what to do.
Sounds good.
And then our training solutions are the answer to that.
Okay.
But I've spent 8 years selling training solutions, not data and analysis. I'm not used to selling to the CEO. I'm used to selling to their employees. Say again?
They just want the data.
They just want the data.
The higher up you go, just for everybody, for enterprise sales, the more money the person makes, the more they don't care about the narrative.
Yeah.
That's just been my experience. Now, of course, stories sell, and there's things like, you want to have a meta narrative if you want. But like, until you show them the math behind it, which is like, what is your return on this?
And that's what they want. So my problem was my churn, I'd lose maybe 20% per year. The ones who'd hire me for training, the students would go, it's the best training I've ever been to. It's amazing. But they wouldn't be able to tell their boss or their boss's boss the data to prove that it was good for retention.
Well, you have to track the data.
You have to track it.
Yeah.
But they would never give me that data. So I couldn't ultimately prove
it. So you have to make a contingent. Like you have to do it.
You have to do it.
You have to do it.
Right.
In order to work with us, like we have a proprietary technology and it feeds off of data. And in order for us to make your product or solution better, we have to get this data so we can implement it in real time. And so right now we're going to start with the vanilla version.
Yep.
But in 2 years, there's going to be the super tailored version to your university. So we know that, you know, all universities benefit from these five things, but there's usually 5 to 10 other things that are we will learn from this data. So you have to do it. So these are the three things that we'll do to make it easier for you to actually get this data back to us so we can help you make more money.
Yeah. Can I ask you one quick follow-up on that? The tool that we do that now is a $30,000 product per year on subscription that universities have started to buy.
Sure.
Before that, our LTV of training was $34,000.
Okay.
So the tool that justifies the $34,000 training is worth
$30,000. Sure.
So that's what I'm wondering. Do I focus more on selling that and then
selling
the training?
Or just sell for 60 if you want and just say it comes with these two things.
It comes with the training.
Sure.
And pivot towards that?
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, like, those are components. I don't even see them as that important. Like the only thing that matters to them is the likelihood that they get their customers to stay and pay longer and renew year after year after year.
Yeah.
And so how we get there matters just really little. And you know this from the sales side. I think you're just into the weeds right now because you're, you know, you have your entrepreneur hat on and you're here. But like, if you're a customer, I don't care if we're going to be doing keto or cutting my calories. Like I just want to be able to fit in my high school jeans.
Yeah.
So just tell me how many. That's it.
Cool, man. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Bet.
I'm a brick and mortar franchise owner.
Sweet.
I own 5 indoor golf simulator locations across the country.
Cool.
I've got FDDs in place to scale up to 12.
Are you franchisor or franchisee?
Franchisees.
Okay, got it.
So one of the constraints that I experience every year is this is predominantly a seasonal business. So when they started in the Midwest and when it's cold and people can't get out to the golf courses, they come indoors and play. Mm-hmm. But the constraint is in the summertime, my utilization just drops right off the table.
Right.
And I'm trying to push forward based on some information I got from customers about what they really like about the place. It's like, you know, time to play a game is much shorter indoors. The weather's always consistent, a lot of things like that. And I'm trying to push my branding in that direction so I can address some of that low utilization in the off season. Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas that you could offer on that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm here in Vegas and I would be like, want to do 18 in under 30 minutes and it be air conditioned with a drink in hand. Like, I mean, you could sell me.
Right.
Yeah, I just like air conditioning in general. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the, because I was thinking, I was like, all right, because a lot, like lawn care guys have the same issue, right? It's like when it's the winter, for them it's the opposite issues. Like, so then they have to get into snow plowing. They call it the on season and off season. Terrible, by the way. If you're in a seasonal business, don't call it the off season because then everyone's going to treat it like the off season. You just lose money the whole time. But I think that perspective makes sense. Like the benefits of indoor. Now, I would bet that the places where it's hottest in the summer might benefit the most from that. It's like get out of the summer heat, and like because you have a time component and you have a comfort component, which I actually think are pretty strong. Mm-hmm. And so I would just be leading with those. Because everyone thinks faster and everyone thinks to be easier. And so you do both.
So just focus my branding and sales in that direction.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. And I was, instead of branding, I would just say this is the messaging. Yeah. Just from a delineation. Yeah.
I'm Millie. I run a math tutoring company with my partner, Christian.
A what training company?
Math tutoring.
Math tutoring.
Yes.
Math.
Very Lovely. Sexy. So right now we're really, really small. Our offer's good. Our sales process is good. We know that we just need to do more of it, which is fine. And we're hiring people to help us with the sales and the fulfillment. What I want to know is you've built a brand where all of your employees seem to have that same let's get shit done attitude as you do. How do you instill that within your team so that they know, like, let's get this done?
You get rid of people who don't have that.
Fair.
And then the only people who are left are people who are that. And then when you bring someone else who's new and they're like, I don't think they have it, you're like, I think you're right. When you let them go.
Simple.
Yeah, it's the hard thing. It's like that girl that's back home that you know that isn't that good, you need to let her go. And then you have to do more interviews and then pick somebody and probably be wrong and do it again until eventually you build the culture based on those values. And you just want to get through that as fast as you can. Because fundamentally, if you're scaling service, you're scaling culture and training. Mm-hmm. If you're scaling a service business.
Yep.
So it's going to be those values and how good you are at giving someone base skills. And so if you think about really in any kind of role, how vague you can be with your directives is directly proportional to how skilled someone is in a given domain. And so if you have people that you're like, I literally have to tell her to turn on the computer, then this person has such low base skills. I think that you can teach anyone anything. I do fundamentally believe that. The question is just, as a business owner, is it worth it? And so it's like, I do think I could change you from being inconsistent to consistent. It's just, how long will that take me? And are there other people who I can get better returns on my time with? And so fundamentally, just think about it like that, is how much training will I have to introduce to this person? Now, if you have a service business that's a small service, is it brick and mortar?
No.
It's online. Well, regardless, your business is going to be also like the training components that like you have culture and training. The culture is what you choose to tolerate internally, but the training is going to be how good, like you're good at teaching math. You have to think about how good you are at teaching people to teach math and teaching people to do every other skill that's associated with teaching math. Because I'll bet you there's plenty of people who are decent at math who suck at teaching math and are even worse at talking to people.
Yes.
Right? And so sometimes you might have to like do a little bit of Dale Carnegie, which is like, okay, so when someone walks in, you greet them with a smile. Here's how you greet people. I'm dead serious.
Yeah.
Like this is like, there's a reason Chick-fil-A, if you're here in the States, is what it is. It's like they teach people how to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
You bet. But that's going to be the differentiator. That's what's going to take you to the next level.
I own a medical spa with my wife.
Sweet.
Yeah. And so.
Love med spas.
We offer a ton of services, anti-aging services. The most popular ones are the least profitable ones.
Cool.
So trying to determine strategy, should we market the ones that are most popular, try to get people in more, and then look to upsell? because the higher margin ones, I mean, you're talking like a 10 to 15x difference in revenue. So I'm just trying to determine, do we market more general, come on in, we'll give you a year plan, or just market the baseline one, come in, and then just try to upsell after that?
This is a great question, and it probably affects a lot of people here. It is a math question, so you can solve this and actually know what the right answer is. And so I'll just give you an example. So let's say Botox is what people come in for example. All right, so how much Botox costs? What's the gross profit on Botox?
So after we factor in all of our fixed costs, like $58 per treatment.
Okay, so you make $58 per Botox. So what does it cost to get somebody in the door?
Right now, our CAC is $202.
Okay, so $202, great. Now, what percentage of these people can you sell into ice, you know, the cool sculpting or whatever else?
We're about like 40%.
Okay, so 40% of the people. And what's the average ticket of the thing they buy, or gross profit of the thing they buy afterwards?
Like $1,300.
Okay. So, whatever this is, that's 400, 520. So, 520 plus 58. So it's this times this, right, is 578. Okay, so this is path one. Now, if you market straight for this thing, what's CAC?
Just overall, I don't know individual per service line, but overall it's just 202.
Okay, so if you basically, so to answer the question, you just promote this up front, see what CAC is. And so here, if you've got 202 to 578, you're like just under 3 to 1, right? And so you're feeling it right now, I'm guessing. You're like, I just need this to be bigger, right? And so I think this upsell efficiency is pretty good, to be honest with you. Now, this you might be able to work on, because I would bet that this can get expanded to like 5 or 6,000, and then that would probably make all the difference in the world. And so in terms of med spas Layla likes med spa stuff, and so I was like, all right, let's just buy a chain, and then you can get stuff for free to save me money. Anyways, but I think this is actually probably where the deficiency is. I actually don't know if it's like $200 is fine, especially if, like, that's what it costs to get somebody for a gym membership, and like, you know, right, like, and that's a way lower LTV than this. So this actually feels like the problem to me, is that. And the conversion's okay. I think you might just need to see if you can sell bigger bundles. Yeah. And you might want to consider, do you have financing?
Yes.
So you have third party or in-house?
Third party.
Huh. Okay, then so you probably have a sales process to you in terms of how you're offering the main thing. And so I would consider, wait till the next book comes out, you're going to love it, doing something called like a menu close. And so you sell the vacation and say, like, okay, if you were to look like a goddess, these are all the things you need. And then everything they cross off, they just look uglier and older. And so they're like, it's like, okay, just look a little bit uglier, a little older. We can cross that off though, no worries. Right, ha ha ha, okay. And so you can start there though. And it's just like, okay, because I'd rather start at ideal and then just try and figure out a way to make it work with their budget than try and just get a sale, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I'm gonna bet that this is the problem. If you want, you could try and market this directly. And then you'd have, I guess, 100% of people that would go into this. Because, like, if you could acquire customers, let's say you acquire these people for $300, then it would make more sense to market that as the front end. My guess, though, is that you just need to boost this guy, because this is fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, I've heard of some med spas paying $200 a lead. So.
So using your delivery cube as an example and LTV to CAC ratio, when you're thinking about modifying components of your offer that are maybe fairly fulfillment intensive, where you have maybe a unicorn or keyman risk, how are you massaging that, or how are you thinking about this problem, knowing that, okay, I can't have the unicorn or keyman risk, I want to increase LTV for my customers, but my customers really like this thing. So think like one-on-one support
for
gym launch.
You have to. So whenever you get into keyman risk in general, just for everybody, it's what makes things rare is combinations. What makes them commoditized is breaking into chunks. And so if someone's an exceptional painter, it's because they can combine color and movement and whatever, you know, like, I don't know painting, but I'm sure there's other components of painting. And so within the support component, there's probably three or four things that this person does very well. And so you just chunk it down. Right? It's kind of like the example I gave yesterday. It's like, how do you replace Alex in this business for delivery? Like, I was key man. Well, I wasn't going to expect somebody to be better at being Alex than me. So I was like, but I can find somebody who's really good at phone sales, who's really good at phone sales, and they're just as good as I am. Now, they're not going to be also as good at retention and strategy and ads, but they can be just as good at that. And then I find somebody else who's really good at ads. I'm like, he's just as good as me at ads. He's just not as good at all the other stuff. And so fundamentally, look, when you scale in a company, that is how you replace key man risk. It's chopping the unicorn's horn off and saying, okay, well, I can find a rhinoceros. And then you're like, okay, now I just need a horse and I need some, you know, fireflies to get the glitter. And there we go. It took three people to, you know, replace my unicorn with things that are more readily available. And so you just chunk down what the skills that this one person has into component parts, and then you can teach those component parts much more easily. So it takes the mysticism out of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was thinking in terms of the, so let's say you have like Zoom community learning management system,
sure.
And the community is becoming the intensive part. I'm not doing the fulfillment, I'm a director of education.
Sure.
Still could parse out the unicorn, but we need to eventually, for scalability purposes, one thing I talked about with Neil is maybe moving people onto like more of a, we already do Zoom, more
so you need to change the offer from one-on-one to semi-private?
It is semi-private already, but there tends to be a time-intensive component of like reviewing specific case studies, if that makes sense.
I will tell you a story to answer, hopefully answer your question. So my first ever gym model, I tweaked a couple times and then I got it right. And I had this setup where people would do 6 weeks of weight loss and kind of like more high intensity training. There's a point to this. And 6 weeks of like weights to tone. So it was like burn and tone. This is commercialized for mass market for those of you who are in the fitness space. Just breathe. All right. And so what ended up happening is that my sessions got so full that I was like, shoot, I should change how I'm doing delivery because I can't fit any more people in my gym, which was the wrong solution. I had found something that everyone actually fucking liked. And so what I should have done was just more of that. And so you're in a situation where you're like, how do I scale delivery more? I don't think your delivery is unscalable. You just need more people to do that thing that people like. And so either do you have margin to support it?
I could probably swing that in terms of just reallocating some of our expenses.
Well, if the answer is not really, then it's you're mispriced. Not necessarily need to change what you're doing. Like, so basically,
it's more of either or. I can either charge more to increase LTV and continue the service up.
Yeah.
Yes,
I will say it's harder to find something that everyone really likes than it is to just change the price. So if you have something that everyone really loves, then you probably can support a price change. And so I want to make sure you're solving the right problem. Like, sure, you can go from semi-private to group, but that might lose all of the value. And if you charge the same thing, now you have your price to value discrepancies out of whack. So what I did, this was the mistake, is I took my sessions and I shortened them so I could fit more sessions in. And by doing that, I destroyed the thing that worked. So don't do that. Product market fit is much harder to find than pricing. Next one. That hopefully applied to somebody else here.
So you've gone over a lot of your successes.
And failures.
What was that?
And failures, go ahead.
Failures, yeah, and so my question is more about your kind of protecting your mental health and your ability with these extreme emotions, because I've gone through both exits and acquisitions the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And I've just never been more miserable. That's
really
the main reason I'm here.
Okay.
Is just either getting resources or connections. I'm just wondering how you've handled when you've had those major losses, when you've lost everything, or when you've kind of had that failures face you in the face, and also if you ever viewed an acquisition as a loss of community.
Sure. So I will not spend a long time on this because it gets into a very heady, chunked up version of reality, which is just like, I believe that when I die within 6 months, no one will give a shit. And so the fact that no one will care 6 months after I am dead for the most significant life event that I have, which is that I am no longer alive, it makes a lot of the other stuff not matter that much. And so I also know that when I was poor and I had nothing, I was about as happy as I am now.
And so if I was just as happy then as I am now, then I could go all the way back there and basically be in the same thing. And I think in some ways, when I really play it out, I get just as excited about the idea of having the comeback story. Now, I'm going to try to not do that. But if I did it, I would get into the state that I think that I'd be like, this is going to be my thing. And so, like, a lot of times the fears we have are catastrophized. And so I want to have this, like, of the many list of books. I have this big document of, like, Alex's list of books that he will someday write. But one of them is Play It Out. And so a thing that I say a lot on quarterlies and strategics is like, let's play it out. Like, what happens next? What happens next? What happens next? And so, like, what actually happens next is not that bad. It's just the idea of it that seems very bad. I mean, Layla has this quote that's the fear is a mile wide and inch deep. It's like you take a step onto it and you're like, oh, this isn't that big of a deal. Like, the worst case is I move back with my parents. Well, actually, you know, I kind of like my parents. And, you know, home-cooked meal's not so bad. You know, I'm only going to see them for 10 more years before they're just old as shit anyways. So, you know, it could be a blessing in disguise. And, like, there's a lot of research that's been done on, like, people who become paralyzed. And within, like, 3 to 6 months, they return to the exact same baseline of subjective well-being as they were when they had all their limbs. And so, as much as that's a terrible thing that could occur, losing money is probably a lot less bad than losing limbs. And if it happened to them and they're just about as happy now as they were 6 months earlier, I just genuinely, like, Layla and I are sit on opposite poles. Like, I struggle to care. She cares so much. And that's how we yin and yang in business, is that she'll get stressed and I'll be like, we can die and no one will care. And, like, when you zoom out, you're like, oh, there's the world. And, like, I'm a monkey on a little thing. Again, this is a worldview thing. Some people don't agree with this, and I've had people get really upset about it. So that's how I deal with it. And so for me, I just don't have really big stakes because I just don't think anyone cares. That's all. Like, the idea that everyone is watching, it just isn't.
I run dental clinic.
Dental, okay.
And our USP is single visit full mouth rehab.
Okay, so, like, veneers and all that?
Yeah,
got it. Okay,
day.
Cool. Okay.
So I don't have revenue retention.
Okay.
I understood what I have to do since yesterday and the ring table of this morning.
Yeah.
But I have to understand from you if you can advise me on, do I have to do a big upsell after?
No. No. So think about it this way. So one of the first jobs I had was at a fur coat dealer. And so you were selling fur coats. So once, now mind you, he can sell more than one coat. You can't sell more than one mouth. But you probably can every 10 years, but let's not get into that. So what he realized, because he was fourth generation, so they had to, like, figure out the business model over, you know, more than 100 years, was that he invented summer storage. And so the idea was, okay, how do we get these people who bought these $5,000 jackets to, like, come back? Because, you know, a big $5,000 coat for the average consumer that was buying it, it's actually an aspirational purchase. So a lot of people think luxury is only for rich people, but 90% of buyers are actually poor people who want to look rich. Fun fact. And so what they found out was, well, if we get people to come back regularly for other stuff, they're more likely to buy more frequently, right? And so what you need is insurance. So when someone buys something very expensive, what you do is you charge 5 to 10% of the total purchase price for insurance. Now, I say insurance with quotes here, but, like, it's, hey, you spent 20 grand on your mouth, spend $1,000 a year to keep it, right? Yeah, to keep it looking nice, because I can double how long these teeth are going to last if you go into our maintenance program. And then you have this long-term care, literally probably be called long-term care, for your mouth. And then that way you can extend the ROI on the investment that you made.
Do you think it's better if I do it after the single sale or between the single?
After.
Okay.
So sell the 20. Then they have the mirror in front of them, and they're like, oh, my God. And you're like, right, you don't want this to go away because this could go away. And only for 5% of the thing you just, like, $1,000 a year, we'll keep it looking nice. And they just spent 20. They're not going to give a shit. It's like, whatever.
Thank you very much. First, thanks for everything.
You bet, man.
We're in the position where we have a couple offers on the table to exit.
Cool.
A couple of LOIs. It's life-changing money, but we believe if we stuck around for 2 to 3 more years, it could be, like, extra life-changing money.
Sure.
So how would you look at this decision and decide when's the right time to exit?
One of the hardest decisions in business. It's a very personal question, and it comes down, and the nice thing is that you have all of the information to make the decision. So on one hand, you have your personal goals, which is like, this is the amount of money that I said I would be willing to part ways with this. This is what I started, whatever.
On the other hand, you also understand how reliable your business is. If you feel like the business has a good leadership team in place, you have plenty of room to expand in the market, the infrastructure is, you know, secure, the revenue that you keep, you have high revenue. Do you have, what's your revenue retention annually?
So our revenue's about 6.1 this year, and our EBITDA is around 2.3.
What's revenue retention? What percentage of that revenue came from the year before?
It's all first one-time sales. So we don't have reoccurring or recurring, which is one of the things that if we added, it would make the
yeah. So you're in like the devil's gambit right now. And so like you're getting an offer, which is great, on something that could also be gone tomorrow with an ad account shut down or whatever, right? I don't know how you get customers, but I'm just assuming. Is it ads?
Yeah.
Okay. And so like there, so it, this is a purely risk. This is a risk assessment. Is if you were like, for sure, we're going to be able to grow, then don't sell. If you're like, I don't know if we're gonna be able to, if we're gonna grow from here, then sell. And so like only you can know that. And I'd say the second, like question 1B, and this is a really big one that I think is underrated, is what are you gonna do after? And so I have friends who've exited, and there's basically like two camps. There's exit and don't have a plan, and exit and know exactly what you're gonna do. And these guys, huge, massive crisis of meaning. These guys, they just get right back to work. And having looked at both of those, like the day after I sold Gym Launch, I started acquisition, and that, like literally the next day. And I'm very happy that I did that. I think having a lot of time and a lot of money and nothing to do, bad combo for entrepreneurs. Personal opinion. So if you are gonna sell, have a very clear idea what you're gonna do next. This is real. This is like a real life decision. And so I don't know what the life-changing money that they're offering is. If someone's offering, you know, 10 times bottom line for something that has one-time transactions and it's all cash, like terms of the deal matter, it's all cash, you can walk away, then yeah, maybe not a bad deal. If it's, you know, seller finance, you can salt back for, you know, a year or 2 years and they're buying, you know, 51%, but you're expected to work for the next however many years, then you basically have a job either way, in which case you're like, okay, this is the frame you can think of. How will my daily behavior change? If what you do every day doesn't change, then why sell it? Which is why for me, the terms of my sale were like, I will stop working the day I get this check. And if you can't do that, then I will not sign the deal.
Yeah, ours is like, we're out once we sign.
Okay. Sure.
Different kinds of offers. It's like majority of the money up front, a little bit of seller financing, a little bit of an earnout.
Yeah.
We're out.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, this is a purely personal decision. I won't take too much more time on it, but like, it's a risk decision, which risk is purely personal. It's like, do you want to put it all in Bitcoin? You could. It's just purely personal.
Can you just tell us to sell it?
You know, sometimes it's like you flip the coin and then you, when it's in the air, you decide what you want to do. I think it's a terrible way to make decisions, but it works for some people. But no, I deliberated about this. Actually, on my YouTube channel, I have a 46-minute video that has like 7 views on it because it's the entire decision-making process around why I sold. And it's like 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. It's a really long video. Like,
we watched that and that's how we backed out of our first
Well, good. I'm glad it served you. But now, I mean, now you got a much better offer. So it just comes down to how risky is it that, because the thing is businesses, and this is one you can write down, businesses will always go up in value until the day they don't, and then they're worth nothing. So a business that grows will always be worth more. Even a business that maintains is worth more the track record they've been consistent. But the day the business goes down, no one touches it. So that's the knife's edge. The longer you keep it, the more valuable it is.
My name's Rick. I'm a law firm owner looking to scale my law firm.
Sure.
And I've identified, you know, brief value of today, I've identified two major constraints. One is the marketing is all outside agencies, and I don't really know a lot about it, so I want to bring that in.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think I need to start hiring higher-level talent to start
basically unicorn parts of what I do.
Yep.
And we are, I guess, another concern would be we are cash flow intensive.
Constrained?
Yeah. So at what point, I guess, do you put it all together? What do you think is the better route to go if you have to do one or the other? Is it the one that attorney, trained attorney, I think both are 6-month endeavors, if I'm just guessing. Recruit and train top talent, or build an in-house marketing team? One brings it in, one gives money. You know, if I have to do one or the other first.
So, I would, because you have a small team. You have 6 people, right? 6 or 7 people, right? So I think that the best, from what I see, the law firms that make the most money are exceptional promoters, especially in the transactional space which you're in. And so I would hire an exceptional agency that has a proven track record, and I would study everything they do. Have you read the agency's chapter in Leeds' book?
I have not.
Read that chapter. So it literally does, like, this is how I do, this is how I learn marketing. So I go to agencies and I say, hey, and I like agencies most times more than the coaching world, because agencies have to produce results or they get fired. And so I go to agencies, ideally ones that have, I get from referrals, and then I tell them, I want to steal everything that you have, but I will do it over a longer period of time because it'll take me time to learn, and I will compensate you for the difference. So your normal people probably turn out at, you know, month 3 or 4. It'll probably take me longer than that. So you'll pay more. I'll pay more there. And then after I do kind of absorb what you're doing, I'll pay you a consulting period after that to make sure I can troubleshoot. So you'll make more LTV than a normal customer. But I'll do that in exchange that I want you to show me what you're doing. This is how I've learned every platform. Yeah. I just pay someone more.
Okay, because the agency I have right now, is there's no transparency.
They right.
Collect money and they give you
right, and that's... Why at the onset, read the chapter. I literally have a script in there of what you say to the person. And if they say no, then you go to another agency and you read the script again.
Okay.
That's what I do.
The answer is agency.
If I were in your position and I had 6 employees, I would rather learn it. Because in order for you to succeed at the level I think you want to succeed at, you've got to know this stuff.
Hey, so first I just
want to
say thank you because you made me a shit ton of money.
You're welcome.
Okay. I built it from concept to fully funded, $32 million.
Awesome.
And then scaled from just me to 133 staff people in 18 months.
Awesome.
So, and I left it because I made a community decision to incubate it at another nonprofit, but I was not the owner.
Okay.
So I built it for them.
Weird.
Now I help career women product.
I made them a shitload of money.
It made them a shitload.
Good.
Yeah, so they.
I'm so happy.
Yeah. So, so that they can become solopreneurs or early stage startup founders.
Cool.
My question here is around your calculus for speed, because for me, I had 9 months to take various firms and stakeholders, pull them together, make a concept, 18 months of diligence, etc. Now I am building a sales team. I'm doing things like the personal brand is me. So my calculus around speed, and that exactly what you shared earlier, the temperature that entrepreneurs are comfortable with, has been hard for me to calibrate, especially because of me.
Do you feel like you're going too fast or too slow?
I think I'm going too slow. And my brain...
You know what's weird is that I have yet to meet an entrepreneur who says that they're going too slow. You're the only one. Every other entrepreneur is like, I'm going way too fast. Things are just happening so fast around me. I'm joking. No entrepreneur says that. Everyone's like, this should have been done 7 years ago. Like, why is this taking so long? Like, I can do this in 5 seconds. Why does it take you 5 years? So I think, first off, it's normal. But let's chunk down a level. What specifically do you feel like is not happening fast enough? So think about it from inputs and outputs. Outputs I don't care about. Outputs occur, revenue occurs, profit occurs as a result of inputs. And so what inputs are not happening fast enough?
So it's, to me, it's the equation of cash flow and closing my learning gap. So for example, I have been like, oh, I am the salesperson, and I'm building, and I'm all of these things which have required me to close my learning gap.
Mm-hmm.
I would prefer to hire someone to like build out the sales team.
But you don't have cash flow yet. Yeah. So when you start, so this, okay, so was the other thing funded that you did?
Yes.
Okay. So this is really cool for everybody. This is a great meta concept. So every single business on planet Earth incurs debt from the day it starts. It's just that the nature of the debt is different. So if you're bootstrapped, you start with leadership debt, management debt, technical debt. You incur all these different types of debt. If you're venture-backed, for example, you incur financial debt. But you can spend the money to get the CRM day one. You can spend the money to get the executive team day one. And so you incur less financial debt, less technical debt, less of all these things, but then you got to pay back the financial debt. Or you just slice down the pie, and so you have a much smaller slice. And so whenever you trade, like you have, there's trade-offs between the types of debt that you choose to incur. And so bootstrap businesses in general take longer to grow because you have the issue that you have right now, which is that you have to keep stockpiling, and you usually have to work double time because you have to do today's job and tomorrow's job in order to generate, basically you do two or three jobs to generate the cash flow from the savings of not paying someone else to do that job to be able to afford to pay the person to do the job that then levels you up to the next job that you can take over that pays even better. And so that's fundamentally the cycle of a bootstrapped entrepreneur. And so I don't think that you're going too slow. It feels slow because you were used to jetpacks that were artificial. No, just being real. Like if you're like, I've got 10 million bucks, let's go. It's a very different starting block, right? Like businesses that I can grow now, I can just fund them to start. And that's where you get real leverage because you get the best of both. Because then you have the capital. You can start like you're venture-backed, but you're the venture-backed company. And so you can start with all the leadership in place, get all the consultants in so that you can get the tech stack and all that stuff, and you can pay for the enterprise savings for a year ahead of time, and you can do all that stuff and not dilute down, but then the company owes me money, but I own the company, so whatever, right? And I know I'm gonna get a good return on capital. And so fundamentally, does that help everybody in terms of thinking about this from a speed perspective? Like, venture-backed companies go faster because they cheat from like the nature of business. It's like they start with a ton of money and they can spend it from money they didn't make. Bootstrapped, you have to make every dollar that you spend. But I think that long-term bootstrap businesses are the most fundamentally sound. I won't even get too much into that because I'll just stop there. All the TLDR is you're going slow because you're comparing it to a venture-backed company. Yeah, you didn't even have revenue or profit goals you had to even hit. So you had like outside money, you weren't accountable for any financial metrics, and you could just hire people. Like, yeah, that's like literally the opposite of a bootstrap business. And so like it's unsurprising that it feels different. So this will be good for everybody. The rate at which you hire is actually a risk question, kind of like we were talking about earlier. And so this is where I made a tweet the other day. It was like, your lifestyle is your competitor's opportunity, which is the amount that you require to live on in distributions is what you can't reinvest in the business. But there's no perfect answer for that. If you have a family with kids, like we were talking about earlier, then I don't see that as bad. It's just that if somebody else you're competing against doesn't have a family and kids and reinvests all that money, then they're going to beat you. But you might not care because you might not be in a business where there's a network effect that like it's a race to the top. Very few businesses are that way. Like if you're trying to build Facebook, then yeah, you probably want to reinvest everything. If you're trying to build a dry cleaning store, probably doesn't matter. And so within the context of your business, I doubt that there are network effects that are going to like kick in at any time reasonable. And if you did, you'd need venture backing to get there in time anyways. So let's just not get into that. The time that you choose to hire that person is basically based on the risk that you're comfortable with dealing. Knowing, like if you know that the business is going to continue to grow, then you're just dragging the growth forward. But you're sacrificing your paycheck so you can pay somebody else so they can drag that growth forward. And so it's a, like the entrepreneur's dilemma is consumption versus investment. As when do I start getting paydays? And it really just depends on you.
All right, so we're kind of doing try to make it short. I feel like I'm at a casino, three blackjack tables, first agency sucked. I get the next dealer, they suck, I go to the next dealer. But I have faith. So we're a company that's driven most of our business, most blind faith.
Yeah.
Most of our business based off of just organic,
cool.
Networking in person.
Cool.
Just trying to figure out like a formula or how to determine a budget.
What do you sell? What do you sell?
Roofing and windows.
Okay, got it. Helpful. Yeah, I mean, most guys who succeeded that are either doing outbound, one, they have referral partners, so they have other businesses that are tangential to windows and roofing that go into customers' homes. This is other home services businesses, and they set up good kickbacks for those sales reps and those people at those businesses, or it's usually PPC-driven or social-driven. So those are kind of like the four most common besides word of mouth, right? That people use to grow those businesses, because we have home services that come through all the time. So very familiar with the model. So the issue that you're having, just so I can restate the problem, is that you've tried three agencies and they have not produced results. So when you say they haven't produced results, did they not produce leads or the leads sucked?
Yes. Both.
Difference?
Both. Yeah.
Okay. Now, so of the ones that produced leads, what was the problem with the leads? Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. So the crappy part with the agency gambit, especially if you don't know what you're doing, is that like you end up getting burned. But it's one of those things where like you're not going to quit, right? And so it's kind of like agencies didn't work for us. It's like, well, there's obviously agencies that are in home services that do great. And so path one is you just keep going until you find an agency. And when you talk to them, you're like, hey, if I don't see results in 30 days, I'm out. But if I do, I'll keep paying you for a very long time. And also ask them for their best practices, because if an agency does not give you best practices, they suck. So just give you that as a warning. So the best agencies will be like, okay, this is the funnel that the leads are coming in on. This is the offer they're seeing. The people who see the most success call leads within 5 minutes. This is the script they use. This is how they maximize show-ups, blah, 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 blah. So they're going to give you their kind of like best system. And some of them will also just work the leads for you, because business owners in general suck at working leads. And so like if you're not getting an agency that's even talking that lingo, then I would say that would be a red flag. So just use that as like at least filter number one. But in terms of like how I would probably approach that business, it would be going to tangential. So it's like carpet cleaning and landscaping and other home services where people are in those on a regular basis, and they see the roof and the windows on a regular, and it's like, hey, I'll give you $1,000 or whatever, you know, whatever your referral fee could be. And so what's your cost to acquire a customer right now?
That's another constraint. That's our numbers.
Okay. Well, how much do you make from a customer on average?
$8,000.
Okay, cool. So you could pay $1,000 for a customer and be happy with it. Is that margin, 8,000, or revenue?
Margin.
Okay, great. Yeah. So then, yeah. I mean, if you give landscapers $1,000 a referral, they will beg, borrow, and steal to get you referrals. And so, obviously, that's a very different strategy for acquisition. If I were in your shoes, fastest, easiest path is look for an agency that follows those check marks. And I don't know how your buying process went, but I would recommend also reading the agency chapter in case you read it. But talk to 10 of them before you buy. Like, actually talk to 10. Sounds crazy.
I think that's been our problem. It's just dating two people and choosing one.
Yeah, like date more than one. It's like, I got a crazy chick and a fat chick, and you're like, ah, you know. You know, so like, whatever. So like, just, you know, like open the pool of who you can pick from, right? So that's kind of where I would go with that. Does that make sense? So just open the selection up, and then I will promise you this. By the time, this is when you know you can pick, so I'll give you the litmus test, is when you stop learning things on the call. So you talk to the first guy, and you're like, okay, that's a lot of new information. Thanks for that. We'll be back to you. Talk to the second guy. He mentions more new stuff. For me, it takes me about 15 calls with experts to really wrap my head around a space. And so that's like kind of like my litmus test. So once I start like being able to say like, but what about this? And what about this consideration? Then they're like, oh, he's a more knowledgeable consumer. And like, I can start talking their lingo. That's how I know I can make an informed decision. So you've been making uninformed decisions, and because of that, been getting bad results, which is not surprising. I meant no insult, to the women in the room. It's just a hypothetical.
In a business like mine, I feel like I've watched your content and I've tried to implement the things, but I feel like it's hard to put it into the things you say because it's a little bit different. I do business loans, and it's very cash heavy up front. And right now, I've realized a constraint is getting new clients and finding a method that works so I can kind of scale that.
Okay. How do you get clients now?
So it's all referrals from previous clients.
Great. And so you've done a good job. What's the average loan?
Sorry?
Average loan?
Right now, it'd probably be around 7,000.
Okay. So this is like credit card stuff?
Sorry?
This is like credit card stuff, or is this like loans?
Loans.
Interesting. Low ticket. Okay. Noted.
There's definitely higher ones.
Yeah.
But usually to start off, we like to start small. And it's
okay. Got it.
Help people build up their credit.
Yeah.
And
so you need more customers.
Need more customers, and okay. We have a way to figure out like how to scale that. We've plateaued, and the good thing about it is we've kind of like built up some money in the bank where we can allow ourselves to maybe do advertising,
mm-hmm.
or I've heard from people have said to do cold outreach.
So for that business, I would especially the ticket price you're at, I would probably go ads or referral partners. So those would be the two channels that I would see as like the most likely to succeed with that. Yeah, sneeze of the event. I just want to sneeze like that and just like see what people do. Anyways, so ads, or I would do the referral partners. And so referral partners would be like, okay, well, who else is dealing with these particular types of customers? So it might be the credit repair companies and saying like, I'm sure they have almost all those guys refer out business. And so making your referral mechanism more valuable than other people's, that would be a big one, because if you can, the way that you can win there is if you convert a higher percentage of their customers than other people do, then you'll be able to pay them more. Because a lot of people waste leads. And there's plenty of companies that just like send the leads and don't even ask for anything back. And so you can be more aggressive on the acquisition to them. You're like, hey, I can extend your LTV. If you just like, once you finish like repairing credit, I can get them a bigger loan and I can pay you. And so getting a handful of those referral partners could be massive for the business. That's like you rely on some other people, but it could scale pretty quickly and it's cheap. Or at least it's low risk.
How do you go about?
That's where you do outreach.
That's where you do.
So you do outreach to get affiliates, and then the affiliates send you business. Then you can be more targeted. That make sense? Because if you do outreach, then it's like, what's the cost to acquire a customer? The metrics there might be pretty tight for you if you were doing $7,000 loans. I don't know what you make on a $7,000 loan.
So we're trying to get into higher.
What do you make on a loan with $7,000?
Generally,
$1,500, $2,000. Okay.
It just depends on what the qualifier.
Yeah, understood. So with like $1,500, $2,000 of gross profit, it's tight. It's very tight for outbound. And so like you'd want more margin if you could. And so that's why you're like, okay, well, I'll go to an affiliate and maybe it cost me 10 grand to acquire an affiliate, but then affiliate is going to send me 20 customers a month. And so it cost me 10 to make 40,000 a month. And then the metrics make amazing sense.
Sorry, just last thing. And if we're, so I have a few clients where I have been able to get to like the higher amount where I'm loaning maybe 50,000, sure. 100,000, like stuff like that. And so we have like maybe three or four of those. How would I be able to maybe reach those like bigger ones so I can, not have to worry about
ads and referral partners?
That would be the next thing.
And if you have referral partners, you tell them who you're looking for. Yeah. We specialize in people with $50,000 loans or higher. If that's, you just tell them what you want. And then you can pay them even fatter slices. So they might be interested in that.